Camels as a means of transportation abound in the Old Testament. When Abraham sends a servant to look for a bride for his son Isaac, that servant chooses Rebekah. And why? Because of her kindness in offering to water the camels. That's just one of dozens of camel cameos in the Bible, mostly in the book of Genesis. But scholars have long suspected that those camel caravans are a literary anachronism. And now more evidence from two Israeli archaeologists. Their radiocarbon technology dated the earliest known remains of domesticated camels. And yes, they came along after the time of Abraham. Carol Myers is a professor of religious studies at Duke University, and she's been thinking about the meaning of camels in the biblical narratives.
It would be like someone owning a huge tractor trailer rig today, the interstate tractor. It's a very expensive item, camels, and very valuable for the economy of the ancient world. But they didn't become important for the economy of the biblical world until about the 10th century BCE.
So what are these findings giving more evidence for, that the camels as depicted in the Old Testament were actually not able to be there as they're depicted in the Old Testament?
But pretty much so. In other words, the stories about Abraham having a lot of camels figuring in the story of Rebekah at the well, those stories are purported to take place hundreds of years before the camel was around, was on the scene as a domesticated animal. The storyteller who's shaping those legends is using what information he knows, which is after the camels are domesticated. And if he wants to show that Abraham is a very important, wealthy figure, what better way than to say that he's got the most expensive vehicle available? It would be like saying he has a fleet of Jaguars or something like that today. We know that Jaguars didn't exist 200 years ago. We have an idea of our history of technology. But somebody formulating this story in, say, the 7th or 6th century BCE, they wouldn't have known that camels didn't come on the scene until after the time when they thought Abraham and Rebekah and the others existed.
So from what you've said, it sounds like it's really good evidence for something that could be considered controversial, which is good evidence for the fact that the texts were written, or at least updated, long after the events they're describing happened.
You nailed it. Yeah, absolutely. It's another piece of a very large set of data that leads us to understand that the kind of literature we have in the Bible is not history in the way that we think of the term history today.
And does it have any effect on the way we understand biblical texts? Does it throw either new light or a shadow on the stories themselves?
I think it sheds new light, not a shadow. In other words, I think it alerts us to the fact that these stories have a very complex history of transmission and formulation. And it makes us think, well, what did the person who kind of collected this and put it in its final form, what was that person thinking? What was the message that person was trying to get across by using all kinds of literary devices, including making Abraham out to be wealthy by giving him camels? It takes us away from asking, is it factual, and asking instead, what does it mean?
Carol Myers is a professor of religious studies at Duke University. Thank you for joining us.
A pleasure. Thank you.
There are probably fewer American fans in Sochi than at previous Winter Games, partly because of security concerns, and partly because it's expensive and time-consuming to get there. But Americans are represented with gusto by a group of evangelical Christians who call themselves International Sports Chaplains. NPR's Corey Flintoff ran into some of them in Sochi, and he sends this postcard.
It's a sunny day at the Olympic Park, with bands playing and fans strolling around the various skating venues, stages, and team pavilions. The chaplains move through the crowd in teams of three or four, engaging with people wherever they can.
My name is Myrna Gregory. I'm from Brandon, Mississippi, which is near Jackson. and I am serving at the Olympics. This is my 7th Olympics to serve as an international sports chaplain.
We love God. We love sports. So what better place to come than one of the greatest sporting events every 2 years to come and tell people about our belief in God.
That's fellow chaplain James Gardner, a minister from West Monroe, Louisiana. This is his 5th Olympics. Most of the people here are decked out in Russian team colors, so the American chaplains stand out.
Well, I've got a black cowboy hat with pins all over it, and then I've got a backpack that's got pins literally all over the back of it. People see that and they want to trade pins, and then trading pins is a good opportunity because I trade a pin, but then I'll usually share with them, hey, I've got a pin I'll give to you. It's got a story. Can I share with you that story? And then therefore we can go about sharing the gospel.
Myrna Gregory tells the story to a young volunteer near the entrance to the park.
Well, see this dark area on the pin? That represents those choices that we make that are probably not the best choice. Mm-hmm. I want to tell you that red represents that God loved us so much that he sent his son Jesus to die for mm-hmm. us. And when we accept his love and his forgiveness in our life, he makes us clean and white, just like snow. Mm-hmm. And then one day when this physical body dies, which it will die one day, we'll spend eternity with him. And the Bible says heaven is paved with streets of gold. And so that is the story behind this pin. Have you ever heard that story before?
No.
Isn't that a beautiful story?
Yes, it's a very beautiful story, but I'm so far from this aspect of our life. It's hard for me to feel deep in it.
In spiritual things?
Yes,
okay.
In spiritual
but that's
things.
Okay.
And so it goes, Southern accents meeting Slavic ones in the Olympic Village. Myrna Gregory says this event has been harder than the other 6 Olympic Games she's attended, in part because there are fewer people who speak English. She thinks concerns about security kept a lot of people away.
I mean, my family, my daughter said, I don't want you to go. You know, we had family and friends that said, we don't want you to go. And I really felt like God was telling me I needed to go.
Before these Olympics are over, 20 international sports chaplains will have answered that call to engage with people at the Winter Games. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Sochi.
Later this month, Pope Francis will welcome his first appointments to the College of Cardinals. Among the 19 men chosen for elevation, 7 are from Central and South America, the Caribbean, and Africa. Some say this reflects the Pope's belief that the Church needs to pay more attention to the poor. One of the bishops comes from Haiti, a country with a long, troubled history with the Catholic Church. Reporter Peter Granitz has the story.
Shibley Langlois says he was skeptical of the news.
I know it from my friends before I know it from the official people who could tell me this news.
You can understand his suspicion, hearing it first from friends, then reading the news online before getting the official call from the Vatican. Langlois says he had no idea he was being considered. He was ordained in 1991 and is the bishop of the Southern Haiti Diocese in Lacaille. Most cardinals are higher-ranking archbishops, and despite his promotion, he still sees himself as a priest, the direct link between the church and the people.
When you feel the call to be a priest, you're called to be a priest. It's not to be a bishop.
Langlois is the first Haitian to be appointed cardinal. He's soft-spoken, smiles at the end of every sentence, and says he's uncomfortable using English, just one of the 5 languages he knows. We meet at the Port-au-Prince offices of the Catholic aid group Caritas. It's where he stays when he's in the capital. And he suggests we talk in the chapel. It's tiny, no more than a table and a couple of chairs. There's a chalice and bag of church wafers sitting on one of them. Duke University historian Laurent Dubois says Haiti and the Vatican had a rough start.
After its independence in 1804, Haiti actually was refused recognition pretty much by all the global powers, France, particularly its former colonizer, the United States, and others. And the Vatican joined that. They refused recognition to Haiti longer than any country except the United States until 1860.
In more recent years, the church has sparred with dictators, serving as a voice for the political opposition. And after the earthquake, the Catholic Church assumed the role of any other aid group, providing grief and trauma counseling, offering health care, and rebuilding homes and hospitals. Langlois says Catholics lost many churches in the disaster, and it's been a struggle to rebuild all of them. Dubois says the Pope's pick of a Haitian reflects an evolution in the church.
It's a little hard perhaps to have imagined it during the past decades when the Catholic Church has been embroiled on so many levels and in very difficult political contexts within Haiti.
Haitians revere February 7th, 1986 as the day dictatorship on the Caribbean nation ended and the struggle for democracy began. This February 7th, Shibley Langlois organized a national day of prayer. Catholics around Haiti gathered at churches like Sainte Thérèse de l'Enfant Jésus to pray for safe and fair elections later this year. Sainte Thérèse was once a towering brick building. Toppled in the earthquake, it's now rows of pews underneath two nylon tents. Outside Sainte Thérèse, parishioner Marta Adelaine Dumanier says Haiti only stands to benefit from Langlois' elevation.
Jesus Christ goes directly into the heart of the Pope. Jesus sees the bad things in Haiti, and he wants to lift Haiti up. Jesus, through the Pope, chose the cardinal to work better for Haiti.
Langlois knows his pick represents a shift in church power. He agrees with Pope Francis's focus on social justice and the poor. In Haiti and beyond, he says, that's not just financial.
Many people can have money, but they are very poor. they don't have the right riches.
He'll divide time between Rome and Lacaille, where he'll continue on as bishop and priest, saying regular mass. For NPR News, I'm Peter Granitz in Port-au-Prince.
You're listening to NPR News.